supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. The organizers of the annual Mummers Parade on New Year's Day will make an 11th-hour decision over the weekend on whether or not to march up Broad Street because of record-breaking cold temperatures. If the Mummers do march, it will be without a handful of non-traditional groups that have decided not to participate this year. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports.
For the last few years now, Mummers have made an effort to be more inclusive. That meant holding sensitivity training workshops last year to tone down offensive behavior and inviting diverse populations to create their own marching brigades. Last year, there was a traditional Puerto Rican act called Los Bomberos de Calle, a Caribbean steel drum band, Mexican carnival marchers, and an Asian group called Southeast by Southeast. None of these groups will be marching this year.
Most people, once they're in the parade, they say it's cold, it's this, it's that, it's the other thing. You know, I tried it once, I'll never do it again.
This is Chuck Tomasco. He's the president of the Landy Comic Club, under which many of these groups marched last year.
And then the other people just say, this is really great, I'll probably do it every year for the rest of my life. That it's usually either love it or hate it. It doesn't seem to be much middle ground.
The groups all have their own reasons for backing out of the parade this year. The Puerto Rican group had a really good time last year, according to Los Bomberos de Calle director Anthony Mendez. But this year, many of the members are too preoccupied with helping their homeland recover from devastating hurricane damage to put together a New Year's act. Other groups found it hard to fit in as mummers because the parade is both a celebration and a contest. The groups are scored by a panel of judges. The Asian group, Southeast by Southeast, marched as a comic club, but their performance had no theme and no skit. The performance was traditional to their Laotian culture, but Tomasco said they weren't funny. They weren't meant to be funny.
Basically, they went out and they blessed the crowd. As a result, when they got scored by Mummer's judges, they were scored very poorly.
Another Mummer comic brigade called the Rabble Rousers is also not marching up Broad Street this year. The troupe is mostly young artists from Kensington and Fishtown, and it's splintering off with its own New Year's Day procession through their neighborhood. Their captain is Jesse Engard.
We're just focusing on like what I think is the basics of mumming, which is going door to door, just being publicly silly and dancing around, honoring what's left behind, what is to come, activating public space and engaging with our neighbors.
The Rabble Rouser procession is loosely organized. There are no judges, no prizes, no definable theme. Engard expects about 50 people to wear costumes and make a lot of noise as they move through parks and playgrounds in the Kensington and Fishtown neighborhoods on Monday afternoon. They will be accompanied by a 20-piece marching band called Three Tons, who flew in from France just to be part of this parade. Rabble Rousers caused a controversy at last year's Mummers Parade when they staged a skit on Broad Street that featured a giant toilet and a person dressed like poop. It was a criticism of the way the Mummers Parade is judged. But Engard says the alternative parade this year is not meant to be an act of rebellion.
We're not doing this as a protest to the parade. We are encouraging some new things to happen with mummery in Philadelphia. And I think there's a lot of missed opportunities to bring this whole city together, and we're just trying to pursue that in the best way possible.
At North Square in Kensington, the Rabble Rouser Parade will be joined by Los Bomberos de Calle, that Puerto Rican troupe. Because even though they pulled out of the proper Mummers Parade on Broad Street, Mendez says he'll be able to get enough people together for an impromptu jam in the neighborhood park. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
On February 1st, inmates using homemade weapons seized a housing unit and took four hostages at the James T. Vaughn Correctional Center in Smyrna, Delaware. WHYY's Mark Eichmann sat down with NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller to look back at how the story evolved over the past year and what developments to expect in 2018. They began their conversation with the day of the riot.
The resulting 18-hour-long riot claimed the life of a correctional officer. Take us back to that day.
Yeah, it was February 1st, mid-morning. Lieutenant Stephen Floyd and a number of other guards at the Vaughan Correctional Center, Delaware's biggest prison, sort of center part of the state, was taken over by a group of inmates, and there were some inmates who were also held captive as part of this, what ended up being a lengthy siege that was eventually, unfortunately, ended in the death of Lieutenant Stephen Floyd, and we're really still seeing how the impacts of that day, of those, you know, less than 20 hours, is still going to impact the prison system and the coming General Assembly session, which starts next month.
Doubly unfortunate in trying to make sense of the precursors to that day. It was the same Stephen Floyd who apparently warned about dangerous conditions in the prison.
Yeah, that's probably the most tragic news that we heard from a massive review of this event, looking into this, that was ordered by Governor John Carney, who himself had only been in office about 2 weeks when this incident happened, so really kind of trial by fire for him. But this 159-page report that looked back at the incident and the factors leading up to it was released in September. And unfortunately, according to that report, Floyd had warned about dangerous conditions in that prison, and specifically about certain inmates who were being allowed to mingle with certain other inmates, and that that was not a safe situation, and that it needed to be changed. Those warnings were not heeded, were not taken seriously, according to this report. And unfortunately, Floyd, a few days later, was killed in the riot.
What were some of the variables that allowed for that, on the face of it, lax system where these inmates were allowed to commingle?
Well, there was a confusion about an order that was based on a lawsuit the previous year about where inmates could be as they were either stepping down or stepping up to either less secure part of the prison or a more secure part of the prison. They would spend maybe a week, maybe a little bit more in transition. And it's in this building C where the riot happened, where those going to a less secure area and more secure area were allowed to be together. So a whole lot of things contributed to this unfortunate incident,
including apparently inadequate staffing of guards in this C building.
Yeah, and that was that's a big problem across the Department of Correction here in Delaware. Really high turnover, which really led to understaffing, and then those correctional officers who were working being required to work involuntary overtime, be frozen in their position, and having to work many, many hours. An audit found that the Department of Correction spent $800,000 on overtime every 2 weeks. For the two-week pay period, they were spending almost $1 million in overtime just to keep the staffing levels up.
And I understand a settlement has recently been enacted regarding the family of Floyd.
Yeah, in December 15th, the settlement was reached. The family, along with six prison employees, had sued the state. That lawsuit included former Delaware governors Jack Markell, also former Governor Ruth Ann Minner before Governor Markell, and accused them of creating dangerous situations at Vaughan Correctional Center, in part because of the understaffing and the over-reliance on overtime is what they cited as really them, the state officials, being derelict in their duties to protect these correctional officers. That was settled for $7.5 million earlier this month. And the state doesn't admit any wrongdoing and says that the lawsuit completely lacked merit, but they're paying to make it go away to avoid the burden and expense that comes with protracted litigation.
Putting legalese aside, is the situation dramatically less dangerous now, 10 months on?
If you ask the Correctional Officers Union, they would definitely say no. The Correctional Officers Union is not happy with staffing levels, even as they try to hire more people with these increased salaries that the state agreed to in June. So it's an ongoing process, and I think they would all say that we're not anywhere near where it needs to be right now.
Thanks, Mark.
My pleasure, Dave.
WHYY's Mark Eichmann on NewsWorks Tonight.
Trenton, New Jersey, was one of only four state capitals in the country not to have a Starbucks. That's until now. The coffee retailer opened a location in downtown Trenton a few weeks ago as part of his Opportunity Cafe program. For WHYY, Sarah Hoover reports.
The brand new Starbucks on the corner of Warren Street and Front Street has a steady stream of customers from the surrounding federal and municipal buildings. Ilya Perez has worked in the area for 15 years and works for the state of New Jersey's Department of Community Affairs. Standing outside the Starbucks, she's a self-described Starbucks fanatic. She's been more than once a day since it opened.
I'm waiting to get on a first-name basis with the barista, so that way when I walk in, they can make my cappuccino.
Perez used to buy coffee from the deli in her building or walk to Dunkin' Donuts.
They're definitely taking business away from other local coffee places, though. We see that already.
Dunkin' Donuts,
yes, the deli. I'd rather walk down here than drink coffee over there.
Another big coffee drinker is Mitul Patel, who also works in state government.
We had a couple of discussions with my coworkers. There's like no real major chains, at least in this part of Trenton, aside from the Dunkin' Donuts. So it's nice having, you know, another option for coffee in the area.
Patel commutes an hour from Central Jersey and expects the new store will bring more economic development, but points out new restaurants and businesses were opening on the block before the Starbucks announcement.
Oh my God, I'm so excited about Starbucks.
That's Joe Festa, owner of the State Barbershop, two doors down from the new coffee shop. He's been on the block for 56 years. Giving a hot shave to a customer, he shares his observations.
I've seen 6-7 people at a time walk by it. It ordinarily wouldn't come out of the building. We need businesses to get these people out of their offices.
The 82-year-old, nicknamed the mayor of Warren Street, was a door greeter at the official opening of Starbucks.
Believe me when I tell you, their presence is going to help the little business guy. Already, I've made new customers on account of Starbucks.
Well, true, yeah. But you're not selling coffee is what I mean.
Well, that's true, too. But again, competition, good competition, never hurt nobody.
Starbucks ended up in the city after U.S. Representative Bonnie Watson Coleman was on a congressional education tour in 2015. It included a tour of Starbucks' headquarters in Seattle, where she learned of their commitment to underserved urban communities. Watson Coleman thought the program would be a good fit for Trenton, which is part of her 12th district.
It's taken young people and people who are currently unemployed and has given them a job in an industry that is purposeful and useful in this economy.
She says it's an economic engine for the county seat where state, municipal, and federal governments and nonprofits don't adequately pay taxes.
The state of New Jersey in the last 8 years has basically starved Trenton and not given it the kind of resources that it needed based upon the burden that just being the state capital has placed on this city. This is just a small city. It's not that large.
Trenton is the corporation's 9th Opportunity Cafe. Stores opened in underserved low-income communities that train and hire young people who face barriers to employment. Other sites include Baltimore, Chicago, Dallas, and Phoenix. Stephanie Campfield, store manager, has 20 employees and says 12 are from Homefront, a local nonprofit that works to end homelessness and break the cycle of poverty. She says some employees were formerly homeless a month ago. Campfield is looking forward to partnering with Homefront and area businesses.
They love that we're here, and they're just really excited that, you know, we can bring some traffic and some business to not only us, but for them as well. They can see the light coming back to life.
Abdul Wiswal is a Trentonian and proprietor of Trenton Coffee House and Vinyl in the South Ward neighborhood, about 5 minutes from downtown. His family-run business started on his bike cart 3 years ago and is now a South Trenton storefront where he roasts on-site.
I'm not concerned too much what happens downtown. The Starbucks downtown is open during state worker hours. I get very few state workers that really want to come out this far or anywhere.
Wiswal says his focus is providing a quality cup of coffee. He isn't worried about competing with Starbucks.
They're selling something that I don't want to sell. I don't want to sell a brand. I don't want to sell a myth.
As for other nearby coffee competitors, Dunkin' Donuts says they haven't noticed a difference, but says they'll have a better sense after the holidays. Next door to Starbucks is the East Front Street Cafe. They say they've had a slump before Starbucks opened, but now see more foot traffic and more people notice them. For WHYY News, Sarah Hoover.
As people all over the world prepare to ring in the new year, many are giving their best guess as to what the future holds in 2018. In their weekly discussion, NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller and Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll, discuss what the American public foresees in the coming year.
Frank, stocks are up, unemployment's down, the new tax law goes into effect. How do Americans envision their balance sheets taking shape in the year ahead?
More positive than negative. 52% of Americans say 2018 will be a year of economic prosperity, and 47% say it will be a year of economic difficulty. So it tilts to the positive, which is good, because in 2013 and even going back to 2005, Americans were more negative than positive. So Americans have tilted to the positive side of the ledger, although not as positive as they were. I'll give you a couple of examples. In the dot-com boom in the late 1990s, and Americans also are not as positive prognosticating as they were back in 1965 when we first asked the question.
Frank, 'tis the season for Gallup's Most Admired Man and Woman report.
That's right. And again, this is an open-ended question. I want to make that clear to our listeners here. We say, who is the man living anywhere in the world whom you most admire? Usually the president wins, but the president did not win this year. This is one of those exceptional years where somebody other than the president wins, and in fact it is the past president, Barack Obama, who edges out Donald Trump. Obama got 17% of all mentions. Trump gets 14%, so Obama is the most admired man. Others on the list this year, but with much smaller percents, are the Pope, Reverend Billy Graham, John McCain, Elon Musk, Bernie Sanders, Bill Gates, Benjamin Netanyahu, the Dalai Lama, Mike Pence, and Jeff Bezos all are on the top 10 list.
A little context. How often is the sitting president bumped from that top spot?
Not frequently. The last time that happened was George W. Bush, and that was in 2008. And Obama had already been elected to replace Bush. And Obama won that year before he even took office, just as he's winning this year, the year after he left office. So that was the last time the sitting president didn't win. And I'll go back. Jimmy Carter in 1980. Didn't win. He was beat by Pope John Paul II. And then after Watergate, we had Nixon and then Ford, who were not the most admired persons in 73, 74, 75. It was Henry Kissinger who won in those years.
How often has Barack Obama won?
Quite frequently. In fact, he's edging up towards the all-time winner, who is General and then President Dwight Eisenhower. And this goes back to 1946. Eisenhower was the single most admired man 12 years. Barack Obama, however, has now won 10 times, so he's coming in just 2 points behind Dwight Eisenhower. Below those two, Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan both won 8 years. George W. Bush won 7 years, and George H.W. Bush and Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson, all presidents, won 4 times each.
You just mentioned Bill Clinton. Did he make the top 10?
He did not. And this is the first time in 25 years that former President Bill Clinton was not on the top 10 list. He used to win regularly when he was president, but he's always appeared on the list since then. But this year, he fell off the top 10 list.
Turning our attention to the women's list, is Hillary Clinton also bumped out of the top 10?
She is not. She, in fact, is the most admired woman in America. Hillary Rodham Clinton has won that distinction more than any other woman in Gallup's history.
Round out that top 10 for women.
Well, in addition to the winner, Hillary Clinton this year, in second place is Michelle Obama, the former First Lady, then Oprah Winfrey, and Oprah Winfrey's been on the list many times, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Germany's Angela Merkel, Queen Elizabeth II, Condoleezza Rice, Melania Trump, the First Lady, but she's way down the list, but she does make an appearance, Nikki Haley, who is our ambassador to the United Nations, Princess Kate Middleton, and Beyoncé.
You noted for the men that Barack Obama was at the top with 17% of the vote. What did Hillary get?
9%, which is down from where she's been previously, but still beats Michelle Obama, who came in second place with 7% of all mentions. Dave, I have a question for you. Who do you think it is that's been on the top 10 list of most admired people that people have now forgotten the most?
I know the list, Frank, but I forget.
Okay. Actually, the one that I talk about the most is Sister Elizabeth Kenney, who is the single most admired woman in America back in 1951. Does that name strike a bell with you?
No, sir.
She was very famous at the time because she had a cure for polio, or what she purported to be a cure for polio, which was rampant at that time before the vaccines came in. She wrapped people in shrouds, I believe, or something like that, and became very famous for that, at least for that brief moment in time. And, of course, now, except for those people who know medical history, she's faded from our memory. But back in 51, she was the most admired woman in America.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. News director Eugene San. Our assistant news director is Katie Colinari. John Mussoni is assistant vice president for news operations. Our engineers this week were Charlie Kyer and Adam Staniszewski. Sandra Clark is vice president for news and civic dialogue. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.